Hello and welcome back to Otoscope. My name is Eliano and this month CG and I are bringing science to your ears. This is obviously not the best time to be inside a small studio with other people, so we had to switch to recording these interviews online, and this one was recorded at the end of last year. CG and I spoke with Dr. Irene Miguel Aliaga about the research on the gut of fruit flies, how sex affects biological processes, and also how it affects careers in science.
So, welcome, Irene. Thank you for accepting our invitation. It's a privilege to discuss science with you, and we have to say it was difficult to decide on a specific topic because you have published so many interesting stories lately.
Thank you.
So, I hope that you can give us an overview of all the things your group has been working on over the years. So, we want to start by asking, how did you end up becoming a group leader? And coming from a neurodevelopment background from your PhD, what made you specifically interested in studying gut physiology?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I think it was a little bit by accident. And also it was a multi-step process, I would say. I mean, I wasn't like one of these. Sometimes you read interviews with all these famous people who say, I knew from when I was a little child that I wanted to run a research lab. That wasn't the case for me at all. I became interested in biology, and that's why I did sort of studied biology. And then I thought it might be interesting to have a go at research and see what it was like. So I decided to do a PhD. But I must say, for example, even the decision to do a PhD wasn't a very calculated decision. I just wanted to live abroad for a year or so. So I applied for various things, and amongst them was a fellowship that allowed me to pursue research in the UK for 1 year. So I said, oh, great. So, I can live in the UK for 1 year and also do some research. So I did that. And then that turned into a PhD. And then even at the end of the PhD, I wasn't particularly sort of committed to becoming a group leader. I just thought that I found research interesting, and doing a postdoc was kind of the natural next step. And as a postdoc, I mean, I was really interested in my research, but I also did other things. I used to write press releases for a scientific journal, and I enjoy that too. It was only really towards the end of my first postdoc that I felt that that's in the direction I wanted to go to. And then progressively, as I sort of did a second postdoc and then established my own lab, my interest kind of transitioned from developmental neurobiology to kind of gut physiology. And again, that was kind of a little bit of a multi-step process. So we found neurons that innervated the gut, and we didn't know very much about these neurons. We started looking at them, from the perspective of how they're made, but then we wondered about what they did, right? And then just looking at what neurons do, we became interested about what the gut itself does and how it changes and that kind of thing. So I think it was all rather progressive.
Yeah, so you kind of just followed your curiosity rather than having this as a goal from the first
place. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it doesn't have to be like that. For me, it was like that.
Yeah, just out of curiosity, what did you want to be when you were a child then?
All sorts of things. a writer, a vet, an astronaut, a musician.
Nice. In a way, you are a writer, so.
I guess I'm a writer and kind of a vet. Well, the opposite of a vet, right?
Yeah.
I do dissect animals. But
yeah. I mean, ultimately, you may help vet medicine.
Maybe I'll make them better eventually.
Yeah. So, another question that we have, I mean, you are obviously interested in gut physiology and you do this using fruit flies. And when you think of a fruit fly, it seems very different from a human in terms of trying to model diseases or even to other mammals. So could you just talk a little bit about what makes the fruit fly special and good for your specific interest?
I mean, I guess there's two things here. So my specific interest, I guess, would be not necessarily to model human disease A, right?
Mm-hmm.
In any experimental system, it would be to discover new ways in which biology works, right? And I find that the fly very powerful for that, because you know, we can conduct these very large unbiased screens with no a priori knowledge about a process or a priori bias about gene A or gene B. And that will point us in a new direction. And you know, and that will allow us to find new biology. And then, of course, you want to know, is that relevant to, you know, is that broadly relevant? Yeah. Is that, might that be relevant in humans? And that's something that you can explore down the line. But I think it's really the first step of discovery that I find the fly particularly powerful for. And in the context of what we do, which is this kind of inter-organ communication, I think that is a particularly good system for that, because it's really easy to sort of stop things or induce things from one organ and then see what happened in an adjacent organ, in a neighboring organ. And that's something that we still struggle. So we do some mouse work as well, but we it's harder to do it systems other than the fly.
Yeah. So in a way, kind of you start in the fly and then you see if this process is conserved and how relevant it is then to, let's say, systems that are closer to our human system.
Yeah, but as a primary kind of discovery tool, I find it really powerful.
Yeah. Well, talking about this organ communication that you just mentioned, you have several publications about this. So can you give us an example of how important it is to understand this?
Yeah, sure. So I guess I'd probably say two different things. So one of them is, I think if collectively our work over the years has shown us something, I think it's the importance of these previously unrecognized gut-gonad axis, if you want to call it that way, right? So it turns out that a lot of what happens in the intestine is very important for reproduction, both of male and female flies. But it's also very different between male and female flies, right? So there is a gut-gonad axis in terms of communication that is very important for regulating food intake and for regulating fertility in both males and females. But the nature of the signals that they exchange, they're very different, and the kind of mechanisms involved are also very different. So that's one sort of discovery that I think would have been quite hard to make in other systems, in which you, for example, mutate something in the gut, but you don't necessarily know what it might be doing or how it might be signaling to other tissues, right?
Yeah.
And a little bit related to that, but not necessarily only to do with that, is this idea that the three-dimensional arrangement of organs matter. And that's something that we've become really interested in exploring. Actually, we just had that meeting earlier. We were just discussing the latest data that we have on this. And that's something that was revealed by a couple of our studies, both in males and females, most recently in males, where we found the testes and the gut right next to each other. Mm-hmm. And they actually exchange signals between them. And this kind of local crosstalk between adjacent organs is important for food intake regulation and for male fertility. But now we think that this may be the tip of a very big iceberg, and that one of the reasons why our organs are arranged in a particular way within the body cavity is not just so that they fit within the body cavity, but there might be some logic and some spatial restrictions that enable perhaps local signaling between them, and that matters physiologically. So that's what exploring at the moment. And again, it's kind of a discovery that I just simply cannot see how we would have made without flies.
Yeah.
Trying to do this kind of thing in a different system.
Yeah, that's very interesting. So you think that, for example, in that specific example of the gut and the testes, do you think that they may be direct contact, let's say, rather than things going to the equivalent to the blood in flies, let's say? So do you think it's possible to have kind of a direct contact?
It may not necessarily require direct contact between the two organs, but it may require that the two organs become sort of adjacent, sort of next to each other, right, close to each other, so that they can exchange the signals. And it's maybe not only what it enables, but also what it prevents from happening, right? So by segregating maybe the signaling, it also confines the signaling in a three-dimensional way, so that it only happens in one place and not another place. So one example is, I think, JAK-STAT signaling. I think now there's many studies, not just ours, but quite a few others, that show that JAK-STAT signaling is kind of signaling currency across organs, right? But that begs the question of, well, how does JAK-STAT signaling do this? And it also does that, but it doesn't, you know, how do you prevent one single signal from activating everything, right? Yeah. So perhaps, and this is just speculation, by sort of segregating it three-dimensionally, you can make sure that two organs use the same kind of language, but in different places to achieve different things. Again, just an idea.
It's an interesting idea.
So we talked about publications just now, and we actually realized you recently published a paper in Nature article, and it's about gut neurons and pregnancy. Could you give us a brief summary of the findings in this paper and, you know, what can we learn from this paper?
So the summary, so I'll tell you the sort of fly finding first. So what intrigued us initially and that made us look at these neurons, so this paper is about these neurons that regulate food intake in mated flies, which would be the kind of fly equivalent of pregnancy, if you like. So but as a fly is making loads of eggs, what we find is that mated flies, like pregnant or lactating females, they increase their food intake after mating. And we knew that there was a neuronal component to this, but we didn't really know what neuronal mechanism made them eat more post-mating. So that was kind of knowledge that was in sort of that was known before in the fly field. Our entry point into this was actually quite different. We were just quite curious to sort of characterize all the neuronal diversity in the fly gut. We just wanted to know what neurons were there, what they did, what they looked like, that kind of thing. So that's work that was started in the lab years ago now by Daphne and quite a few other people. Daphne Hadjiakonomou, who's the first author of this study. We just came across these neurons that we found interesting because they innovated structure of the fly digestive system that is known as the CROP. And actually some fly people don't even know about it either because it's only present in adults. So it's not present in the juvenile stages of flies. And it was a pretty obscure organ. It'd been quite overlooked historically. I think we hadn't really paid much attention to it. So we were quite curious to explore what these neurons may be doing. And what we found actually is that these neurons, they kind of listen to the mating status of the fly. So they know when the fly has mated. And the mechanism by which they become aware of how the fly has mated is actually quite interesting because they receive two signals. So they receive one signal, which is a steroid hormone in the female fly, a steroid hormone that increases post-mating. So this is called ecdysone in flies. But then also they receive a second signal that comes from the gut itself. So a finding that we had made quite a few years ago now is that in female flies, when they're reproducing, the gut grows in size, so it becomes larger. So the number of cells within this gut, they increase. And along with this remodeling comes the remodeling of these so-called enteroendocrine cells in the gut. So these are cells that make hormones, that put hormones into the circulation. So one such enteroendocrine cell increases in number post-mating, and these neurons are listening to this change. So the neurons integrate this information. So the steroid hormone coming from the ovary, probably, and the gut hormone coming from the gut. And then they know that the fly has mated. And then that kind of awakens these enteric neurons, these gut neurons, and that makes them change the way that the stomach that they innervate feels, so this crop-like structure, right? Yeah. And then by doing that, what they do is to increase the food intake of the fly. And we can go into details about how they do that. We think it's through some sort of suction mechanism by changing how the stomach-like crop feels. But effectively, the net effect of the whole thing is that these neurons know that the fly is reproducing. And as a result, they make the fly increase food intake, and that maximizes fertility of the fly. So if we prevent this reproductive remodeling of these neurons, the fecundity of the fly goes down.
Yeah. This crop that you are speaking about, could you explain a little bit what is the normal function, let's say? Why is it there if it is so obscure and people haven't really explored? Did you, in the end, in this study, or do you know kind of what the function of this is?
Yeah, so historically, if you read articles about it, it's normally referred to as a sort of storage organ, as a storage bag even. So I think historically it was believed more to be like a passive reservoir of food, right? But how that was regulated or why it was regulated, it wasn't really very clear. And what we see now is that food always enters this crop before it goes down, you know, further down the digestive system for digestion. We also see that it expresses gastric enzymes, this crop, and that it's innervated. So overall, we're beginning to see it more like a kind of stomach-like organ. And there's been also a couple of recent studies that have made new links between this crop and the regulation of food intake in other contexts.
Yeah.
So we
yeah.
think that collectively, I think we do think that it's an organ that by regulating how it fills and how it empties, it modulates food intake. And we do see it very much more generally as a reproductive organ. Mm-hmm. And this is because of the work in which we see that by changing the way it enlarges, we can change food intake, but also because in other insects, it fulfills other kind of reproductive functions. So, for example, the regurgitation of nuptial gifts and all sorts of really weird things in other insect species that may also be mediated by the crop. And as I said, you don't find it in kind of baby flies, so you only find it in the adult, which again is consistent with the fact that it might have more of a reproductive role.
Yeah, interesting. Getting back to the example you gave, I think a very good and visual example of how kind of plastic these organs are in the flies, especially in response to reproduction, is the example you just gave about how the guts can become much larger than they usually are. Do you know how this happens? And I mean, what consequences this can have in terms of physiology, not only for, let's say, food absorption, because this would be the more obvious example, but also how other functions of the gut are affected.
So that's something that we're currently looking into in a bit more detail. So what we definitely know from flies is that both the remodeling of the neurons that I've told you about, the reproductive remodeling of the neurons, and the increase in size of the gut need to happen to maximize fecundity, right? So if we prevent them from happening, we get reduced number of eggs. Some of it may have to do, as you say, with nutrient extraction. I think that there's probably also a component of signaling. Mm-hmm. So we know, for example, that and this is not our work, this is work by Yusuke Niwa's lab. We know, for example, that interendocrine cells of the gut can signal to the female reproductive system. And as we are learning also from our own work, I think that the sort of a proximity aspect may also be relevant in this kind of signaling between the two, also in the context of reproduction. So that's in flies. In mice, we know that this happens as well. So we have more of a phenomenal sort of descriptive understanding of the process, and we're beginning to characterize this process in more detail. And this really happens also in us. It happens in cattle. I mean, this kind of resizing of the intestine during reproduction in females is actually probably a very wide phenomenon. So we need to understand in these other species how and why it happens, I think.
Yeah.
So yeah, interesting. So yeah, you said about the plasticity of the internal organs before and after mating. And actually, I think one of your major findings in some other papers is also about the differences in the plasticity between male and female organs. We also learned that this may translate into a different risk of certain disease, such as cancer. So can you give us more information about this?
Yeah, So wherever we look, we're finding loads of sex differences, I think. And I think historically there was this view that it was mainly the reproductive systems that kind of acquired the sexual fate. So they became male or female. And that sort of had a knock-on effect on the physiology of other organs, right? I think there's increasing realization, and this is clearly not just it's work by many labs, that many other organs and many other cell types have their own sexual fate, their own sexual identity. And also there are various different ways in which this sexual fate can be acquired and can be kind of imparted even across tissues, right? I think what we found in flies is that the sexual fate is acquired both through cell intrinsic and cell extrinsic mechanisms. So what I mean by that is that cells intrinsically know whether they're male or female, but also they kind of listen to their environment. And in this environment is also kind of sexual cues that further masculinize them or feminize them. And historically, I think the kind of fly community and the mammalian or human community had very different ideas about how sexual fate was acquired. So the whole fly community was really dominated by this view that everything was cell intrinsic and flies didn't really have sex hormones. Whereas the mammalian community was really, for them, it was all about sex hormones and sort of intrinsic sexual fate was something that was kind of negligible. I think in recent years, the two communities have become increasingly aware that sort of sexual identity is a little bit a combination of the two factors. and that we may need to consider both, for example, when we're considering things as such as disease susceptibility, which you were alluding to. So I think it'd be really difficult to extrapolate from our fly work what we can say about human disease susceptibility. I think what fly work tells us is that maybe we should consider things that we may not have considered in this context. So I'll just give you an example. So we published back in 2016 that the stem cells, the proliferating cells of the adult intestine of the fly, they have an intrinsic sexual identity. And this sexual identity affects how their susceptibility to tumorigenic insults, right? So the female stem cells divide more than the male stem cells, and that makes them more prone to or more vulnerable to tumors. I think that doesn't tell us anything about human biology, but I think it nonetheless tells us that maybe we should consider potential contributions of the intrinsic sexual identity of stem cells to the sex bias in gastrointestinal tumors that we see in humans.
Yeah, and if you look at human disease, I mean, most diseases, one of the risk factors is if you are either a male or female. So certain types of cancer, certain types of even gut disease like Crohn's disease, you have sex risk factor. So
absolutely.
I think, yeah, it's something interesting to look up. And also this leads me to my question, which is how important do you think that in every study that we have a male and female kind of results for both male and female, since, I mean, even if it is the same organ, that same organ can have different aspects depending on if it is from a male or from a female.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, I mean, it's good practice, right? I think it's good experimental practice. We should all do that. And and there's very compelling data out there where you see this kind of distribution, which is kind of quite noisy. But I can't remember. I think it was some sort of physiological trait. I can't remember what it was, glucose level, something like that, which you see a pretty sort of noisy distribution, a pretty broad distribution. And then actually when you segregate it into males and females, which they had, right, and they had not considered that sort of sex dimension to this research, and then you can see that there's a very clear difference, and then suddenly the distributions are a lot narrower. And what was masked there was a sex difference. So I think it's absolutely crucial that for every, I mean, as I was saying, it's rare. I think it's more the exception than the rule that we don't find a sex difference in a particular feature when we start quantifying it. So I think it's definitely good practice. And I know some funders are requiring for most research proposals actually consider both sexes unless there's a very good reason not to do so. And I think everyone should do that.
Yeah, so we've been thinking about sex differences in terms of biology, but now we would like to bring some controversy into a conversation in our segment, Autoclave. In this segment, we bring some hot and pressing issues to discussion, and today we have been talking about, again, sex differences in biology, but we are interested in discussing a more sociological topic and know your opinion about sex differences in careers and more specifically in scientific careers.
So I'll start with the first question. So yeah, nowadays more and more women are getting into science, but at top academic positions, there's still a discrepancy in the ratio of males and females. Have you ever experienced a challenge during your career life that, you know, is relevant to this? And do you think enough has been done to address this difference?
Yes. I mean, I guess, as you say, I think up to the sort of student and postdoc level, at least in the UK, for example, we're kind of 50%, right? And then this massive reduction in the number of women. And that carries on, right, all the way up to, you know, really the top positions in science where you hardly see any women. So I think there's probably the main reason why that happens is that the environment that these women experience, right, and how they experience it probably differently as well, and how it impacts them differently. So say, I have loads of discussions about this, and often the sort of two salient points that people become fixated with, this kind of perceived lack of confidence in women, right? Somehow we have a deficiency, we're not confident enough, and that's why we cannot progress through the scientific path. And the second one is childcare, right? So somehow, you know, we have babies and that holds us back. And you know, and then if you have more than one, it's more of a problem. And childcare typically falls on, you know, differentially affects women because they sort of take on more childcare duties overall. And as a result, you end up with what you end up with. And I'm not saying, you know, these are not true. But what I'm saying is that maybe it's not really that women need to do something about this, mm-hmm. right? So say, for example, this perceived lack of confidence, maybe we place too much emphasis on confidence, right? I mean, this pandemic, maybe it's a good example of the of sort of pitfalls of confidence, right? And I think what you need is really competence and not confidence. And actually what comes across as a sort of confident leader may not be what we need. And yet we still select very much for these kind of attributes in science. And so that's one example. Then the one about childcare as well is like, well, yes, yeah, so again, it's about changing our environment and the kind of expectations placed differentially maybe on men and women. So we had attended a useful meeting recently. It was a symposium on gender in academia organized by Embo and Howard Hughes. And there were quite nice metrics about couples and how they handle childcare. And because, you know, we also put everyone in the same bag, right? So we assume all women are the ones that do the childcare and then men are the ones that whose wives are looking after the children. But actually, there's also a subset of men that actually contribute equally to childcare. Yeah. And they struggle. Just, I mean, as assistant professors, it was also shown that actually you find very few of them in the sort of top positions. So we also need to make sure that all these people can reach, not just women, but also these men. You know, men and women that choose to sort of juggle family with academia, we also need to ensure that all of them reach these kind of top positions, right? So we need to, when considering applicants for jobs, we're considering people for promotions, I think we need to consider their broader impact rather than only their kind of publications and track record, right? So what other factors have been sort of affecting their career and also how they behave themselves and how they conduct themselves to make our environment a kind of family friendly environment. So I think it's about broadening what we value sort of as leadership qualities and also broadening what we value about the behavior of scientists in the workplace. And then maybe we would have less of an issue with this kind of career progression or lack thereof.
Yeah. And another thing that we wanted to ask is in 2018, you were awarded a Suffrage Science Human in Science Award, which was repeated again last week. Can you talk about this award and what this award means and actually what it meant to you to receive this award?
Yeah, so this award was established by Mandy Fisher, the director of the LMS, quite a few years ago. And I think it was inspired by the suffragette movement. So I think that was a nice thing to sort of, I think the idea was to create a little bit of an alternative community of women in science. So the sort of the award physically, it's a really beautiful heirloom. So inspired by the suffragette movement that gets passed on every 2 years from scientist to scientist. So the idea is that, you know, you keep it for 2 years, you get to wear it, and then you pass it on to a scientist that you kind of look up to, a female scientist that you look up to. And typically, I think what we all kind of value and what we sort of the reasons why we choose our next awardees is a combination of scientific excellence, but also all these other qualities that I was alluding to earlier. So you respect these women, not just for their scientific achievements, but also for their contributions to the community. So yeah, it meant a lot to me because I think to me it was a recognition of both sort of the scientific achievements, but also these maybe other dimension that we tend not to consider science so much.
So in this award, you had to choose the next recipient of this prize. So what kind of qualities did you look for or do you admire in other women in science to make this very difficult choice, I imagine?
Yeah, it was a very tough choice. And actually, it was good that I had 2 years to think about it, make my decision last minute. So I chose Gisu van der Goot at the EPFL in Lausanne. And I guess I chose her for three reasons. So one is her scientific creativity. I think she does very original work about sort of at the interface of cell biology, physiology, pathogens, and that kind of thing. But then also, I think because she's also a very for kind of her human quality. So she's not just a scientist. I think there's a human dimension to her that I liked. And I guess I also picked her because of our kind of unconnectedness, if you like. So, and that's the reason I think that my predecessor chose me as well. So I think, you know, there's currently these networks in science that are quite powerful. And and you kind of become aware of them as you sort of progress through your careers, in which you know, people nominate other people for prizes, either because, you know, perhaps they're their progeny and that makes them look good, or perhaps if I nominate you for X, you can nominate for Y. Yeah. So they want that benefit, right? And I don't think these networks are particularly good for science, I must say.
Yeah.
So I think what I wanted to do as well by choosing somebody with whom I had no kind of strategic links or interests, mm-hmm. to nominate that person. So that was also part of my choice.
Yeah.
And perhaps we can foster a new community in which people are connected in a kind of different way, and sort of we can all keep in touch and, you know, discuss science and discuss, you know, women, yeah. in science issues in a way that kind of connects us without necessarily being this kind of clubby, sort of networky, sort of prize giving network. So yeah, that was part of it as well.
That's great. Thank you for sharing your insightful opinions on science and career. I just have one last question before we finish. Do you have any advice to young women or men who are just starting their career in science, just like Iriano and I, or even school students who are interested?
Become a radio broadcaster.
Yeah. Becoming a scientist. Scientist in the future. Can you give any advice?
It's always difficult. It's difficult to give advice because I think everyone's different, right? So there isn't like a one sort of kind of advice that would fit everyone. I mean, I think it's important. One thing that I think is important is that you should do, you know, what you enjoy, right? And you know, I think a career in science is great if you do enjoy science, and because it's still hard work, right? And there's no denying that. So, I mean, I think you don't mind the hard work if you really enjoy what you do and you derive pleasure from what you do. Otherwise, perhaps it's better not to do it and, you know, do radio. I think that you should do that. But what I mean is there are many other things, right? I mean, I think there's also these single channel, and you see that as a PI as well, right? So somehow you almost feel that the only success in an academic path is academia itself, right? And actually, that's not necessarily true either. And I think at any point in the sort of academic sort of career ladder, there are many other sort of turns at your career.
Mm-hmm.
So many other options, right? So I think that's fine. And I think there are sort of transferable skills that you can use along the way that may be useful in other things you choose to pursue. So I think it is important to try to enjoy what you do. And then also, I mean, of course, that's not just about your mindset and your attitude. It's also about your environment, right? So, you know, maybe that also includes trying to make the environment a better place for everyone, and maybe hopefully a more inclusive place.
Yeah. Oh, thank you very much, Irene. It was
thank you.
Very
thank you. Thank you very much.
Now, to finish this episode, we have our publication of the month.
Extra, extra!
This month, we are discussing a publication that shows that a synaptic density marker is reduced in schizophrenia patients and it's unaffected by antipsychotics in rats. To talk about this paper, we have the first author, Alice Shika-Onworthy, from the psychiatric imaging group here at the LMS. Hi, Alice. I hope I said your name correctly. Because
yeah, that's fine. Yeah.
Thanks again for accepting our invitation to speak to our podcast. And yeah, congrats on your paper.
Thanks.
I thought we could perhaps start by clarifying what this title means, let's say. So what does synaptic density mean? And specifically, what does it mean for these patients to have a lower density in certain parts of the brain?
Yes. Okay. So basically, as you say, this paper focuses on the synaptic density marker, SV2A. And there are many different ways of looking at synaptic density. And historically, we've sort of relied on sort of post-mortem studies. So mm-hmm. looking at things like dendritic spines on which synapses form, as a way of quantifying synaptic density. Another method is looking at synaptic protein markers and characterizing and quantifying the amount of synaptic, presynaptic or postsynaptic protein markers in the brain. And that as well gives us an idea as to how many synapses and the density of synapses. So in, you know, a unit of tissue, if you've got more of a particular presynaptic marker, take, for example, synaptophysin, which is a widely used presynaptic marker of synaptic density. If you have more of synapsophytin, then you've got more synaptic density. So that's basically what's meant by that. Obviously, with this paper, we look at a different synaptic density marker. We're looking at a different protein, specifically the protein is SV2A.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's a protein which is ubiquitously expressed throughout the brain. It's found specifically in presynaptic vesicles, in the membrane of those vesicles, in every synapse. So it basically allows us to, it works as a good surrogate for where synapses are, essentially. Mm-hmm. So by looking at that protein in particular, we're able to look at synaptic density.
Yeah. So could this be used, let's say, as a biomarker for this disease? Because usually when you diagnose psychiatric disease and specifically schizophrenia, it's mostly based on clinical interviews. So could this be a complementary approach to diagnose the disease?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, that's certainly an interesting line of inquiry, and that's potentially something which may develop from investigation of this. That said, obviously, we've got to do things in a typically slow, methodical sort of way. You know, this is the first study that's looked at synaptic density in vivo, in the living human brain, in schizophrenia. So we did find that it is reduced in key areas of the brain, the frontal cortex, the anterior cingulate cortex, and other cortical regions as well. But you know, there's a long way to go. This sort of proves the concept that's been identified in post-mortem studies, which have shown reductions of different markers of synaptic density. What we've done is we've seen it now in living patients who have chronic schizophrenia. It would be useful, obviously, to develop biomarkers that allow us to get a clear indication, you know, which are both sensitive and specific. There's a clear indication as to whether someone has schizophrenia or not, but we're a long way off from that.
Yeah.
Not least we have to tackle many compounds which exist. You know, in this study, obviously, we attempt to tackle the compound of antipsychotic medication. Yeah. And so all of our patients were taking antipsychotic medication. It's been unknown as to whether antipsychotic drugs affect synaptic density. So we looked in rodents, in rats, to see if there's any effect of antipsychotics on our marker SV2A. We didn't find an effect.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously, you know, we want to go a step further and look at people who've not had any antipsychotic medication at all.
Yeah.
You know, unmedicated patients. You know, but if we see then that these differences still exist, then we're sort of moving further along that path towards, you know, generating a biomarker. But still many steps would exist along the way. Not least, you know, the questions about feasibility in terms of implementing it clinically. But yeah, we don't have to get into that now.
Yeah. Yeah, you just mentioned these antipsychotics that you gave to rats and you see no effect. So do you think there's a way to target this marker, this synaptic density marker? And do you think that may have an impact on perhaps on disease treatment or on trying to slow the progression, especially at the beginning? Could you just tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose that's the thing, really. So if you anticipate, as we do, that loss of synaptic density is associated with the onset of schizophrenia, then really we want to be looking at that stage to see if there are ways of mitigating the loss of synaptic density, or at the very least of sort of, you know, providing like, you know, prognostic indicators which allow us to implement treatment more rapidly and hopefully therefore more effectively.
Yeah.
I suppose, what was the second part of your question? So,
it was more about if we can at least slow down the progression, because you mentioned in the paper that this may be happening in the early stage, this synaptic loss. So I was just wondering if you think that targeting this specific protein or other proteins in synapses would potentially slow down the progression or even cure this disease.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, so that's an open question, really. So there are ways of targeting SV2A specifically. There are drugs which bind to it, commonly used, widely available drugs, such as levetiracetam, which is typically used in epilepsy for seizure control. So levetiracetam binds to SV2A, and there is evidence that it does have some implications for things like cognition, for memory as well. And these are things which are implicated in schizophrenia, rather, which are deficient in schizophrenia. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it'd be interesting to see whether use of drugs like that would have a beneficial impact on patients with schizophrenia in terms of their symptoms and their signs. But as you correctly mentioned, obviously prevention is better than cure. And if we were able to develop a biomarker which could identify synaptic loss, which was excessive for the age group of the patient, if there was some way of mitigating that loss, that would be potentially very interesting and potentially useful. But there's a lot of work to be done to show definitively. We don't know for sure that synaptic density loss leads to schizophrenia. It could just be sort of epiphenomenal event, which doesn't, changing that doesn't necessarily modify disease status. So that's something which work needs to be done to show whether or not there's an effect of synaptic density or relationship with symptom severity, with cognition, and so on.
Yeah, I guess it's a work that you will probably continue to to work on. So when you have a new publication, we will invite you back to give us an update on these results. I think it's very exciting. And I think people should read this paper. This paper is in Nature Communications, and the link will be available together with this episode. And thank you very much again.
Thanks for having me.
And that's it for today. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned because next month the topic is very much related to the publication you just heard. Stay safe and see you next month.